All right, it's about time for us to get started this evening. It has been a while since we've been in Numbers. I think it's been probably 3 weeks because we had the class on Numbers 1 and 2, and then there was the hurricane, and then there was the singing. And I think that's all that we missed, but it feels like it's been longer than that. So I don't know that we need to do much by way of reminder for the first couple of chapters. We saw some of the census information in those first couple of chapters, the arrangement of the camp around the tabernacle. We talked about that. Chapters 3 and 4 we'll talk about tonight are two more censuses, and so more excitement of numbers and counting. And we did talk last time about how, you know, we look at these chapters, we're like, oh, numbers, this is awful. But numbers do have meaning to us in a variety of ways if there's context around it. And so hopefully, at least some of what we're doing in this class is giving some context to what's going on. And so we'll continue to try to make that effort this evening by looking at these two chapters, numbers 3 and 4. Let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're thankful to you that you are a God who has redeemed your people, that you've seen us in the slavery that we are in and have sought to free us from that. And we ask that in response we would give ourselves freely and fully to you, to live the kind of life that we should live in service to you, whatever form that service may take. Help us as we study your word tonight to grow in it and to grow to be more like your Son Jesus, in whose name we pray. Okay, so numbers 3 and 4, like I said, this is a couple of censuses. I'm going to try to not have to say that word a whole lot. So, and what makes these different from what we've seen up to this point is that they are counting the Levites in particular. And each of these chapters is a census of the Levites for two different purposes, and they count different groups of the Levites, or they count the Levites in different ways. And so chapter 3, what we will see is it's a counting of all of the Levite males that are more than a month old. And we'll talk about the rationale behind these census arrangements in a second. And then chapter 4 is all of the male Levites between 30 and 50 years of age. Now, this is different. Obviously, they're different from each other, but they're also different from how the 12 tribes were counted before this. Remember, the Levites were not part of that counting earlier on, because in chapters 1 and later on in chapter 26, those two national census takings, what you're counting there are men who are 20 years and older. And the purpose of those censuses is to prepare the nation for war, to know how many soldiers you have, to be ready to go into the land and fight. And so to be numbered for war is one thing. To be numbered for other purposes, you're going to be counting differently for different purposes. And so chapter 3, basically what's going to be happening here is they're comparing the number of Levites with the number of firstborn children in all of the other tribes combined. And we'll talk about the rationale for that here in a second. But basically, the Levites, the male Levites, serve as a ransom for the firstborn Israelites. And so what we need to do is make sure that we have enough Levites to account for all the firstborn Israelites. And so that's the purpose of this census. And again, we'll talk about the why of that here in a second. Chapter 4, however, is something different. So we don't want every single male Levite anymore. Chapter 4 is about the work that is related to the tabernacle, and in particular, the work of hauling the tabernacle around as they move through the wilderness and into the promised land. And so what you want now is a very different group of people, because the work involved with moving the tabernacle is both dangerous and labor-intensive, I guess. You need men at the height of their strength for this job, because, I mean, they're going to be carrying all of this heavy material around for miles at a time. So, you know, you don't want a 12-year-old in this group of people. That's not going to help. You don't want a 75-year-old in this group of people. That's going to be less help. You want men at the height of their strength. but also because it's very dangerous work, because it involves sacred items. One of the things that we have seen already, and we will continue to see, is that if you live in a nation where God lives in your camp, that's both a wonderful thing and a terrifying thing. You walk too close to the tabernacle and you die. You touch the wrong object and you die. You don't follow the rules about something and you die. Living with God next door is a dangerous thing in Leviticus and Numbers. And so you need people who are mature and sober-minded and strong. And so that's presumably at least the rationale for this grouping of the men from 30 to 50, is they kind of fit that particular mold. So that's what's going on in these two chapters. Now let's work through this a little bit more detail. We're not going to take the time to read every verse of both of these chapters, but at least to get a feel for what's going on here. Starting in verses 1 through 4, these are the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. And that by itself kind of reminds you of the book of Genesis, because you know, that's the phrase that recurs all the way through Genesis. These are the generations of, and it's always the story of the descendants of that person. And so these are the generations of Aaron and Moses, and so it's kind of moving us into the next generation, at least, you know, implicitly a little bit, and that's what the book of Numbers is doing, is taking us to the next generation. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, Nadab the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priests, whom he ordained to serve as priests. But Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of Aaron, their father. And so this is, you know, God's handpicked priestly family, who alone are the people that could handle sacrifices and touch the altar and enter into the tabernacle. And, you know, there is, like I said, a danger that goes with this, and we're reminded of it right at the outset. Here are Aaron's four sons. Oh, by the way, two of them are no more because of what they did. And without retreading the ground of Leviticus 10, you're at least familiar with the story of Nadab and Abihu, that they offered this strange fire before the Lord and were killed as a result of it. And again, the danger of a holy God living with a sinful people. We saw that back in chapter 1, and it's been a little while, so I'll flip back to it. In verse 51, when the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down. When the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. And if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. And in verse 53, but the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of testimony, so that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the people of Israel. And the Levites shall keep guard over the tabernacle of the testimony. And so the Levites are this buffer zone to keep the people away, but they end up being more than just a buffer zone to keep the people away, because in this chapter, in chapter 3, notice down in verse 10, you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall guard their priesthood. But if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. And then down in verse 13, for all the firstborn are mine. On that day I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. That's not the verse I want. I'm not sure what that one's supposed to be. But then down in verse 38, I hope. Those who were to camp before the tabernacle on the east, before the tent of meeting toward the sunrise, were Moses and Aaron and his sons guarding the sanctuary itself to protect the people of Israel, and any outsider who came near was to be put to death. And there's another reference in there that says basically the same thing. We find the same thing in chapter 4 a couple of times as well. And so they're not just a buffer zone, they're the guards is what they are. And this is less of they come in and so you arrest them and call the judge and you have a trial and then they're executed. And this is less of that judicial process and more of, you know, the police officer shoots the bank robber in the bank. That's, I think, the idea, is it's just summary execution. You walk in this and the person kills you for violating this area, a bit like Eliezer will do with the adulterers in Midian later on, which we'll come to in the Balaam story. So again, there is just this danger of this. It's a great privilege for God to be in their presence, but there's a danger with it as well. And if you are one of these people, the stakes are even higher. You know, it's dangerous enough to be in the tribe of Simeon over there somewhere, wherever they are. The closer you get, the more dangerous it is. The more holy things that you handle along the way, the more holy things that you touch and carry, the more dangerous it is. It's kind of funny because I was one of the things that I was reading about this. I saw a line that I couldn't help but think of the movie version of Spider-Man, one of the movie versions of Spider-Man, where Uncle Ben had to say like a million times in the movie, "With great power comes great responsibility," and you're just kind of sick of it by the end. And this commentator who wrote long before that movie came out said, "With great privilege went immense responsibility." I was like, "Hey, it's Uncle Ben." But obviously there's truth in that. The closer you are to God, the more obligations God gives you, the more responsibility you have, the more dangerous it is along the way. And so carelessness in serving a holy God can be fatal, is the upshot of all of this. And I think there is a principle in that that pushes forward, you know, to the here and now, as we think less about the danger side of it and more about the side that God has chosen certain people for certain tasks. The family of Aaron, he has put here to do this thing. The priest, you know, as you move out from that into to the extended family, they have certain role. The Levites, they have certain role. And the different groups of Levites, as we will see, they have different roles along the way. The tribes, they're doing different things. And God has put each of these tribes and each of these families and each of these groups in their place to do their job that he wants them to do. And their job is to do that job. I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, Korah is going to find out later on, is you can't just say, I think it's okay for me to do this too. You know, that's, then the earth opens and swallows you up, right? Or, you know, Aaron and Miriam, those are the two, who say, you know, what's so special about Moses? And God says, I'll tell you what's so special about Moses. You're not him, first of all. And so he has put these people in their place, in their role, for their purpose. And as we bring that forward, I mean, God has today in the church certain qualifications for ministers and for elders and for deacons, for example. And some of those things seem hopelessly old-fashioned to our society. And it puts us in a position where we say, okay, you know, do we change with the times and have a, you know, gentler, more inclusive sort of worship? Well, you know, Jeroboam did that. That worked out great, right? That's what some of these other people are trying. You know, Moses and Aaron and Miriam want to be involved in more things. Korah and his group think they should be involved in more things. I mean, do we follow God's ways, or do we follow the ways of the age in which we live? I mean, we may say, well, why is it, you know, that women can't teach publicly, for example? You know, that seems so backwards and old-fashioned and sexist and all of those things. I mean, I know plenty of women who are brilliant, who know a lot about the Bible, and are fantastic public speakers. Why can't we be edified by them in their teaching? That doesn't make any sense to me. Well, you know, maybe it doesn't, and maybe that's okay. Maybe we don't have to understand every detail about why God is so precise in his instructions about who serves him, as much as we need to understand that he is precise in his instructions about who serves him. And if God has this kind of precision that he spells out this clearly, then, you know, maybe we shouldn't join along with Korah and Miriam and Aaron and start questioning that and trying to suggest something different is the way to go. And ultimately, what we need to remember is that, you know, different roles for different people is how God has ordained his people to work from the very beginning. And, you know, any service offered to the king, however humble it might be, is a glory, because you're serving the king. And I think that's where we need to find ourselves, is to not think about, how does my work for God compare to that person's work for God, and compare them one-to-one and think it's better or it's worse, or it's, you know, this or it's that. What we need to do is look at the fact that we're working for God. And that in itself is an amazing, amazing thing. And, you know, that's not just within the context of the congregation. That's beyond these walls and the work that we do. We silo off our life sometimes into the secular and the sacred. And the Bible has none of that. All work is done for the Lord if you're doing it the right way. And if you are working for the Lord in your secular job, there is a sacredness to that because you are working for the King. And so I think this is maybe a little bit of an extension pushing the limits of what is a legitimate reading of this text, but I do think those are the sorts of things that we can think about, practically speaking, as we reflect on the fact that God is looking at these people and saying, you are special to do this, you are special to do this, you are special to do this, the rest of you are serving me in some other way. That doesn't mean that, you know, God likes some of them more than others. No, they're just serving him in different ways. And we see that in the New Testament as well, Paul's illustration of the body and how the body works and all of those things. So, we need to move on from that. So, verses 5 through 10 give us the idea of what the Levites are doing, generally speaking. And we won't read all of this right now. But notice verse 6, bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before Aaron the priest, so they may minister to him. They shall keep guard over him and over the whole congregation before the tent of meeting as they minister at the tabernacle. And this is a verse that kind of gives us the basis of what the Levites are going to be doing. Some translations are vague with it. The Hebrew here is a bit ambiguous, but I think the context makes it clear what they're doing. So, for example, the New American Standard says, they shall perform the duties for him, that is Aaron, and for the whole congregation in front of the tent of the meeting, and they shall do the service of the tabernacle. So they are doing duties for Aaron and service of the tabernacle. And you say, I have no idea what that means. That could be like a million different things because it's pretty vague. The NIV says they are to perform duties for him and for the whole community of the tent of meeting by doing the work of the tabernacle. And so we've got work instead of service, which still may be slightly more helpful. But basically what you have in the broader context of these chapters is there are two things that they are doing. They are guarding the tabernacle, and the ESV that I'm reading from even picks that up and translates that first word as guarding the furnishings of the tent in verse 8, keeping guard over Aaron in verse 7. So the idea of guarding the sacred space is a big part of what they're doing. And the other part of what they're doing is the heavy work of the tabernacle, which includes, in this context, the dismantling and transporting and re-erecting of the tabernacle everywhere they go. And so there is service that is done at the tabernacle while it's up, but what these chapters are primarily talking about is who's carrying what as the tabernacle gets moved. And so that is going to be what a lot of this winds up being about. Now, verses 11 through 13 then come back to this first census and what's going to be happening here. And so verses 11 through 13, we will read this. The Lord said to Moses, saying, behold, I've taken the Levites from among the people of Israel. Instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the people of Israel, the Levites shall be mine, for all the firstborn are mine. On that day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated for my own all the firstborn in Israel, both of man and beast. They shall be mine. I am the Lord. And so this is the fundamental premise that's going to stand behind this. The firstborn belong to God. They are His. And it kind of fits with the idea of, you know, the first fruits sacrifice. The first belongs to God. In this context, it's seen even as related to the Passover, the first Passover, where the Egyptian firstborn were killed and the Israelite firstborn weren't killed. God took the Egyptian firstborns and he left the Israelite firstborns, but he says, they're still mine. They belong to God. And how does that work, that they belong to God? Well, there's a couple of different things that could happen in someone belonging to God. You think in terms of Samuel, for example, who his mother dedicates him to the Lord, and he lives his life in service of the temple. Or you think of Molech, the pagan deity, who was worshipped by child sacrifice. And just as the first fruits were given to God in a sacrifice, the firstborn could be given to God in a sacrifice in some of the pagan religions. Now, obviously, that's not what God wants. But one way or the other, the firstborn should belong to God. But what God says here is, instead of the firstborn belonging to me, presumably in service to him, the entire tribe of Levi is taking their place and belonging to him in service to him. So what we need then is enough Levites to account for every firstborn of Israel. And so that's the purpose of this census and what it's all going to be about, the firstborn being dedicated to God and the Levites taking their place as this ransom for them. And so as the census gets taken then in verses 14 through 39, it's divided up into these three major clans or families of the Levites. And so we get the numbers here and what their primary job is going to be as well. So of Gershon, there are 7,500. And notice in verses 25 and 26, we find out what their task is going to be. The guard duty of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involved the tabernacle, the tent with its covering, the screen for the entrance of the tent of meeting, the hangings of the court, the screen for the door of the court that is around the tabernacle and around the altar and its cords, all the service connected with these. And so this part of the tabernacle is what they're going to be dealing with. And that's going to include, again, taking it down and packing it up and carrying it along, those kinds of things. The Kohathites, there are 8,600 of them. And in verses 31 and 32, we are told their guard duty involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, the vessels of the sanctuary with which the priests minister, and the screen, all the service connected with these. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, was to be chief over the chiefs of the Levites and have oversight of those who kept guard over the sanctuary. Now, we're going to jump ahead for a second while we're talking about the Kohathites. Notice they are dealing with the just about the most holy stuff there is, right? They are dealing with the ark and the table and the lampstand and the altars. All of the stuff in the holiest of holies and in the holy place. That's what they're dealing with. So this is, in terms of, you know, religious tiers, this is the highest level that there is, which gives, again, that puts them the closest to God in the most dangerous place of all. And you notice this then in chapter 4 and verse 4, when they're talking about this. This is the service of the sons of Kohath in the tent of meeting, the most holy things. When the camp is to set out, Aaron and his sons shall go in and take down the veil of the screen and cover the ark of the testimony with it. And they shall put on it a covering of goat skin and spread this cloth over it and so forth and so on. Then down in verse 15, and when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary as the camp sets out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these, but they must not touch the holy things, lest they die. These are the things of the tent of meeting that the sons of Kohath are to carry. And then down in verses 17 and following, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and said, "Let not the tribe of the clans of the Kohathites be destroyed from among the Levites, but deal thus with them, that they may live and not die when they come near to the most holy things. Aaron and his sons shall go in and appoint them each to his task and to his burden, but they shall not go in to look at the holy things, even for a moment, lest they die." And so they are in charge of all of these most holy things in terms of carrying them, but they cannot touch them, and they cannot look at them. And so they have this, you know, most important job, but they are not allowed to do the packing of any of these things. They can only transport them. And so that's kind of an interesting piece of this as well. And we'll come back to the other two in a second in the context of chapter 4. So that's the Kohathites. The last ones are the family of Merari. And they are in verses 36 and 37. There are 6,200 of them. And the appointed guard duty of the sons of Merari involved the frames of the tabernacle, the bars, the pillars, the bases, and all their accessories, all the service connected with these, the pillars around the court with their bases and their pegs and their cords. And so this is going to be their job. Now, the difference between them and the Kohathites is that they were able to do the packing of their own things for hauling this around, but they did so under the supervision of the priesthood. So notice in chapter 4 now, again, verse 28 this time. This is the service of the clans of the son of the Gershonites in the tent of meeting, and their guard duty is to be under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. And then in verse 33, this is the service of the clans of the son of Merari. The whole of their service is in the tent of meeting under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. And so they're able to do their work, but it is under the strict supervision of the priest that they are doing these things. So that's the main groups, the numbers of them, what their job is going to be as it relates to the tabernacle, what they're in charge of moving from one place to another and setting up and taking down, except for the Kohathites that don't take down anything. They stand back and they don't die is what they do. And then they are the ones who move it. Now, the total number of all of this is 22,000 Levites. And in verses 40 and following, so verse 42, Moses listed all the firstborn among the people of Israel as the Lord commanded him, and all the firstborn males according to the number of names from a month old and upward were 22,273. So, you know, we've got a little shortage of Levites is what we have. So what do we do to solve this problem? Well, the Lord says, take the Levites, verse 45, instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel, and all the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle. The Levites shall be mine, I am the Lord. And as the redemption price for the 273 of the firstborn of the people of Israel, over and above the number of the male Levites, you shall take 5 shekels per head, and you shall take them according to the shekel of the sanctuary, the shekel of the 20 gerahs, and give the money to Aaron and his sons as the redemption price for those who are over. And so this was the approximate value of, this sounds awful, this was the approximate value of a human life. And what I mean when I say that is that if these people were taken into captivity and sold on the open market as a slave, this would have been basically what their cost would have been at this point in history. So the point is everyone has been ransomed except this 273, and it is the cost of that life. In that basic wage system is what they're being. So they're being ransomed in that particular sense. So that's a lot of me talking about a lot of dull stuff. So questions, comments about anything? Start right here with Ethan.
One thing that I noticed too, when you add up Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, it ends up being 22,300. And I have heard that the number 6 and the number 3 in Hebrew are very similar.
Anytime you're dealing with numbers and translation, it's a mess. I don't know the answer to that. I probably should have run across that somewhere. But it's probably a scribal error or some other funky thing going on with the translation of numbers. Hebrew numbers are not, they're not like Arabic numerals that are distinct from the letters. So it's just kind of, it can get messy sometimes. So my guess is that the 22,000 is right, and somewhere else in the rest of it is where the glitch is happening. So, but yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Gary?
I'm just curious about something. In verse 14, you said goatskin. Aha. In the American standard, it says
porpoise. Yes, we are going to come to that. Because those aren't the only two options. So I've got a couple of things which I'm kind of in my own mind, at least I'm categorizing as a little bit of interesting levity in the midst of all of this dullness. So we will be coming to that here in just a moment. So hang on to that one. I've got all the major options on the screen here in a second. What else? Anything else here? All right. Well, continuing on then. So chapter 4 kind of gives us, again, the details of transporting the tabernacle and the ark from place to place. And we talked about this already. You know, the Kohathites are carrying the most important, most holy things. They're not allowed to do the packing of that. The Gershonites and Merarites, they're doing the packing and the unpacking under supervision, but they wind up not carrying them. It's not talked about here in Numbers 4, but when you get to chapter 7, what you find is all of those things are being loaded on carts and moved by cart. Whereas the Kohathites are actually carrying things, like, you know, the ark is to be carried and not carried, hauled on a cart. Just ask Uzzah, right? And that may even be part of the background of why they thought to put it on a cart in that day, as everything else gets carried on a cart. But whatever the case may be, a lot of this is going to be moved in a different way. So, again, what you see is that there is, and I don't want to belabor this point, but there is this kind of hierarchy within the Israelite social order. And we talked about that last time, and I wish I'd put that slide back on the screen this time, of the tabernacle and the arrangement of the camps around it, where in the most important spot, that was Moses and Aaron and the high priestly family, and then the other various priestly families are situated around in order of importance, and then the tribes were situated around in order of importance, where, you know, Judah is in the prime place, as one of the ones on that side. And so there is this clear hierarchy in how they thought about the tribes, how God arranged the tribes, the work that God is giving to the tribes. But even so, you know, like I said, you come back to the New Testament and there's this analogy of the body where it might seem that some parts are of the body are more glorious than others, but sometimes the less glorious parts are doing the more important work. And I think Paul makes that point very well. Or you think of the parable of the talents, where different people are given different obligations, different responsibility, different levels of responsibility based on their ability to do things, to handle this obligation that they're given. But they're all going to be judged based on what they do with what they have. And so, again, the degrees of holiness, so to speak, that's what a lot of this is. You know, the more holy you are in this ranking, the closer you can get to God. Degrees of holiness doesn't correspond to levels of divine favor. If it corresponds to anything, it corresponds to danger for your life. The more holy of a place that you're in, the more holy you have to remain in order to remain, I guess. The closer you get to God, the more dangerous it is. And there's a sense in which you could say, well, maybe it would be better if God wasn't there. If the closer you get to Him, the worse that it is. But, of course, at the same time, without God, they're completely lost. And they're not going to make any progress anywhere in the wilderness or to anything, and they'd still be in Egyptian slavery. And so the realization that, you know, however dangerous it might seem, it still far outweighs the alternative. And so there's a lot of interesting sorts of things to kind of think through there, and maybe we can come back to some of that here in a little bit in wrestling with this. But like I said, there's a couple of things that are worth noting here that kind of, like I said, gives you a little bit of a little bit more lighthearted, perhaps, way of thinking about things. One is the Ark of the Covenant. This is obviously just some random artist representation of it that I pulled off the internet. My guess is most of you have seen an Ark of the Covenant that looks something like this, more or less, give or take. Let me ask you, and notice here the carrying poles run down the long side of the ark. Have any of you ever seen it situated this way with the carrying poles on the short side? Is that completely new? A few people are nodding. Some people are not. Okay. Well, this is an interesting thing to think about because the text never specifies which way the poles face. And the reason that I bring this up is because my guess is that this is probably accurate, and that's probably inaccurate. And the reason why I would say that is you stop and think about what the Ark is. What is the Ark of the Covenant? What does it represent? The throne of God, right? And so you put this in an ancient context, or even in a modern context every now and then, you can probably find pictures of British monarchy being carried around on a throne of some kind. And which way does the king face when he's sitting on his throne being carried? Forward. Now, if the cherubim are, you know, on opposite sides of the seat, or his feet, if it's his footstool, however you want to envision that, and the ark is going this way, then God is riding side saddle. There's a sentence I wasn't sure I was ever going to say in my life. God is pointing the wrong direction. However, if this is the arrangement, God is facing forward as he is being carried, which makes perfect sense. And so the fundamental question here is ultimately going to be, you know, what is the purpose of these poles? Is it to carry it to represent God being carried on his throne, or is it just to be able to move it from place to place? If it's just pragmatic moving it from place to place, I don't know that it matters. A lot of the times that it's carried, we see in this chapter, it gets covered up and carried. And so if it's covered up and carried, then it may not matter one way or the other. I get the impression, although I don't think it's ever explicitly said in the Bible, but I get the impression when the ark is carried into battle, it's probably not covered up when it's carried into battle. But again, I don't know that. It would make sense for it to be open and shown as the throne of their king. But this makes more sense of the idea of a throne being carried. I'll at least say that. So as the ark is carried, they cover it up. And notice the work that is done here. Verse 5, when the camp is to set out, Aaron and his sons shall go in and take down the veil of the screen and cover the ark of the testimony with it. Then they shall put on a covering of something and spread on top of that a cloth of all blue and shall put it put in its poles. And over the table of the bread of the presence, they shall spread a cloth of blue and put on it the plates, the dishes, the incense, the bowls, and the flagons for the drink offering, and so forth and so on. And that's going to be covered with scarlet. And ultimately, the only thing that's going to be covered with blue is the ark, with the blue exposed. And so it's noticeable what this is as opposed to everything else. But the blue and scarlet and purple, those colors run through all of this. And the exact significance of those colors is never stated explicitly anywhere. I think a safe presumption is that those are colors that are typically associated with royalty. And it's a reminder that this is God's throne and the tabernacle is God's palace, so to speak. And this is their king who lives in their midst. And if that's not what the colors represent, I don't know what it does. So let's come back to this goat skin. So you've got, what did you say, porpoise? Anyone have anything different there? This is, and don't feel compelled to go looking on the internet for every option. I'll give you every option. This is, what's that?
Badger.
Badger, yeah, badger's another one. So this is chapter 4 and verse 6 is one of the places it shows up. Badger, porpoise, and goat. Three drastically different things. Well, here are our options from a variety of translations, and some of them you're not going to recognize. I'll tell you what they are. So the Old American Standard says sealskin. The Christian Standard and the New American Standard Revision of 2020 says fine leather, as does the New Revised Standard as well. I didn't put it up there. DRA is the Douay-Rheims translation. It's the Americanized version of the Douay-Rheims. It says violet skins, and so you have a color instead of an animal. The ESV says goat skin. The Holman Christian Standard says manatee skin. The International Standard Version says leather-dyed skin. The King James, the New King James, says badger. The New American Bible Revised Edition says a cover of yellow-orange skin. So we're back to colors again instead of an animal of some kind. The New American Standard 95 revision says porpoiseskin. The New Century Bible, oh no, New Catholic Bible says sheepskins. The NIV 1978 says hides of sea cows, and the 2011 NIV says durable leather, and the Orthodox Jewish Bible says it is a tahash hide covering, and that's the we give up, here's the Hebrew word. So that's just the Hebrew word there. So what on earth is going on here? I think probably the best bet is to take a vote, and we'll just go with what everyone likes the best. Well, no. This is one of those places, and I bring this up because I think it's something to at least mention from time to time, in addition to just the, you know, kind of funny absurdity of this. You know, there are times that we struggle with translation. That's just the nature of translating from one language to another. Particularly when a word only shows up once in the entire language. The way you determine meaning is context. And the more times a word shows up, the better you know what it means because you've seen it function in a whole bunch of different places. And there are lots of places that words only show up once in the Bible, and sometimes only show up once in all of the ancient literature. And it gets really hard to know what that word means in that kind of context. And I don't have the statistics on this word. I didn't look it up to see if it's one of these words. I'll mention this in case any of you are ever doing any reading. If you're reading something, or reading a commentary or something, and you see the author mention a hapax or a hapax legomenon or a hapax legomena, that is this case, a word that only shows up once. So if you ever run across that, that's what that means. And so we struggle with translation from time to time to know exactly what it means. But I would say that every time that is an issue, you know, what is hanging in the balance theologically? What about your relationship with God is do we need to worry about? You know, so this is what you find, is that, yeah, we don't know what this means for sure, but it's not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. But usually when we struggle with translation, we don't struggle this badly. And so the history of this particular issue, for what it's worth, the oldest translations we have understood it to be a color of some kind. And there's a lot of colors going on in Numbers 4. And so they're probably drawing from context to say, all of this is about color, so this must be a color of some kind. And violet or yellow, orange aren't even close, so I'm not quite sure how that all works out. But the thought that it would be a color is probably derived from the context of the chapter. A lot of the old Jewish scholars understood it to be an animal of some kind. And so that's where this idea of it being an animal comes from. Now, most of this, I don't know why they pick the animal they pick. But there is one that there is a reasonable explanation for it, but it just because it's reasonable doesn't mean that it's right. So you might remember that... these ancient Semitic languages are consonantal languages. All consonants, no vowels. The vowels were added later on. And most of them are based on three-letter words. And there'll be other letters added if it's functioning in a different purpose or a conjunction's added to it or something. So the letters will get added to it, but there's a three-letter root underneath just about every single word in these Semitic languages. And these different languages are related to each other in various degrees, like, you know, Latin and Italian, and all the different Latin languages are related to each other. So sometimes similarity in those words means something, and sometimes it doesn't. Now, all of that is to say that there's a very similar Arabic word to the Hebrew word here that means dolphin. And based on that Arabic word, we get porpoise, and probably seal skin, and manatee skin, and sea cows. So probably all of those are drawing out of the Arabic connection. The question is, does that Arabic word mean the same thing as the Hebrew word? And I don't know how we could know that. I would say I don't know where they got the porpoise skins from in the middle of the wilderness. I think that's a fair question. I guess God could say, let there be porpoise skins. But, you know, beyond that, I don't know. It's an interesting thing. And like I said, I bring it up just because there's such a wide variety of options here. It is something that does occur from time to time, and I think it's worth thinking about at least. And it's kind of funny, too. Yeah, Kim?
One thing that I notice all consistently is that some kind of, you know, big animal hide that is typically seen as a type of
And it was something that was designed to cover and protect this stuff as it was being carried. And so, yeah, it's in the final analysis, knowing exactly what it is, it's just not that big of a deal. It's an interesting little trivial sort of thing to stop for a few seconds on. And that's about as far as it goes. So, but most of the rest of Numbers 4 is less interesting than that. So, like I said, the bulk of this, and there's not a whole lot that needs to be spelled out or described. It's telling them what they do and what they carry and where they go. And we get the numbers of the different tribes. And this time it's not like, oh no, it doesn't match the number of the firstborn, so what do we do? So it's just pretty straightforward through the rest of this chapter. But that said, was there anything in what we've talked about tonight, neither chapter or anything that we didn't get to in chapter 4, that anyone really wanted to ask a question about? All right, well, we will stop there, and we'll just plan on picking up in chapter 5. Probably do the same thing, cover a couple chapters. We'll see how it all breaks out in the end, but probably at least two chapters, maybe three, maybe one, you know, something like that, depending on what I find once I start digging into it. Well, thanks for your attention and comments tonight.